When Russell Baker was growing up, his mother used to push him to make something of himself. He did. He started his career as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. After working his way up to London bureau chief and White House correspondent, he moved to the New York Times. 8 years later, in 1962, he got his own column, The Observer. His humorous takes on the issues of the day won him national recognition. In 1979, he received a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Baker won his second Pulitzer in 1982 for his memoir Growing Up, which told how he was shaped by the Depression and by a mother who planned to live out her ambitions through her son. Baker takes his story through the next stage of his life in his new book, The Good Times. It focuses on his years as a reporter from 1947 until 1962, when he became a columnist. I asked him which period of his life was easier to put into focus, his childhood or his early professional career.
It's much easier to deal with childhood. It's because you're so far removed from it. You can look at it with great detachment. It's something that happened a long time ago, and what you remember from it, you remember very clearly, with crystal clarity, but you don't remember a great deal. When I was writing about being a reporter in this book, I was dealing with materials which are swarming in my head. The real problem when you get dealing with that stage of your life is what to discard. You know, you have to leave out almost everything.
Mm-hmm. You have to maybe be more diplomatic, too, since you're
to be
talking,
more diplomatic?
Yeah, you're talking about colleagues here and newspapers and
Of course. That's why, that's why the closer you get to the time you write a memoir to your own age, the more lies are built into it. I can be brutally honest with myself as I was at the age of 5, 10, 15. I can be pretty damned honest about the way I was at 25 to 35. But if you ask me about what happened last week, I'll tell you 3 or 4 lies. I have to. You know, it's too embarrassing to be absolutely honest about things that are that close to you.
Mm-hmm. When you entered newspaper writing, and this was in the late 1940s, you describe it as not only not a prestigious position, but you describe it as being in the social pit. Did that bother you or bother your mother, who was so ambitious on your behalf?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, my mother regarded newspaper work as honorable work because she'd had this cousin who became managing editor of the New York Times, a man named Edwin James. And she thought that being a newspaper man was a very important work. She thought it was more important than I thought it, as a matter of fact. It was, when I went into newspaper work, I was 22 years old, right out of college, and I had the young person's view of life, that what was worth doing was to do something artistic or creative, as they say these days. Terrible word. And I thought that would be writing novels. You know, I wanted to be a great novelist. Newspaper men were hacks to me. They wrote for money. And there's something dishonest about that, artistically dishonest. It lacked integrity. I wanted to be a great novelist. That was where integrity lay. Well, of course, the problem was that I couldn't write a novel. And worse than that, I wasn't even interested in writing a novel. I sat down and tried to write one. It bored me stiff. So I was one of those people who, they're quite common. You find people who want to be great writers, but they don't want to write. I wanted to be a great novelist, but I didn't want to write novels.
Did you love newspapers?
Did I love newspapers?
Yeah. Reading them?
Not at first. I got in the habit. Well, I'd always read newspapers since I was a kid. You know, I started reading the comics, and then I'd start reading the news. Used to live in New York and read the Journal American, a Hearst paper. It had wonderful columns, and there was wonderful crime coverage, and I loved crime coverage, particularly back in those days in the 1930s. There were a lot of executions. People were being fried regularly or hung. And I loved reading about the condemned man going to the chair, what he'd eaten for the last meal, and that whole grisly rigmarole.
It's funny that you like that so much, because when you were actually called on to cover a hanging and an electrocution, you did your damnedest to not go.
I certainly did. The thought of having to stand and sit in that penitentiary over in Baltimore and watch some guy drop right in front of my eyes with a rope around his neck was more than I could contemplate. But by that time, I'd been civilized, you see. As a child, you love violence, and something happens to you along the way. You get that civilized out of you.
Russell Baker is my guest, and he's just written a new memoir called The Good Times. It's a sequel to his Pulitzer Prize-winning earlier memoir called Growing Up. Your first work on the newspaper was covering the police beat, and then you ended up on Rewrite. You were surprised that the Rewrite man actually wrote everything in the newspaper, that the reporters didn't do it themselves. Once you were in the position of writing the stories that were phoned in, did you find yourself resorting to newspaper cliches or a lot, or doing your best to get around them and to be as original as possible?
Oh, at first, no. I think you learn all writing by imitating. You know, I really think that you read somebody you admire and you write like that. And then you read somebody else and try to write like that. You begin writing as a plagiarist. And once I started doing newspaper work, I tried to write the way I conceived newspaper men wrote. So I picked up all this newspaper argot. You know, the hailstones were always as big as golf balls. The rain was a deluge. A fire was not a big fire, it was a holocaust. Kids who stuck up cab drivers weren't kids who stuck up cab drivers, they were bandits. Everything was romanticized in this overstated, old-fashioned kind of newspaper lingo. And I've always had a gift for cliché, for aping aping bad English. It came naturally to me. I can say without boasting, because it's certainly nothing to boast about, that I was a very good police rewrite man.
It seems to me that as you became more and more advanced as a reporter, you became more and more aware of the fact that you weren't much interested in politics, government, or the national scene. Is that right?
Well, I'd been, you know, I had nothing but the best assignments. I got off the police rewrite in Baltimore. I was sent to London to be London bureau chief for the Baltimore Sun. I was brought back to be White House correspondent, and then the Times hired me, and I covered presidents. I covered the State Department. I covered the Senate. I ran around with all those guys running for president, Eisenhower, Kefauver, Adlai Stevenson, Jack Kennedy, Nixon. And I was away from home all the time. Meantime, I had three children and a family, and they were growing up without me. But my regular beat as old age began to grip me around the age of 37 was covering the Senate. And I was beginning to question the value of what I was doing. My father, one of the key events of my life, my father died when I was 5 years old. Had a tremendous impact on me. He was 33, died at 33. And I was covering a meeting of the Senate Armed Services Committee in the Senate one day. Closed meeting. We all reporters had to sit outside on the floor, wait for them to come out and posture or distort or lie outright about what had really gone on inside. And it was a long meeting, and I sat there and sat there. And I was 37 years old at that time, and I thought, see, here I am, 37 years old. When my father was 37, he'd been dead for 4 years. But in his lifetime, he had made something. He was a stonemason. He'd made something you could touch, that people could use, that you could see. And I thought, what am I making? I'm not making anything here. And I thought, instead, I'm sitting here wearing out my hams, waiting for somebody to come out and lie to me. And that was the stage at which I think I was finally grown up. That was the last moment of being young. And after that, it was a very quick transition out of reporting.
What you're saying doesn't make complete sense to me, because, okay, maybe your father was making something more tangible, but you certainly made made an impact in reporting I don't really understand why you need it. As a writer, you know, why you needed something like more tangible.
I had become scared about reporting. I had lost my faith in reporting, that reporting was a worthy way for a grown man to spend his life, because I thought it's so difficult to get it right. And particularly when you get beyond police-type things. Sure, you can get the name of the dead person right and how many bullets are in the body, but when you get to covering the Senate, the questions are so subtle that often you don't even know what the right question is to ask. And the more I understood about reporting world events and national events and politics, the more it seemed to me that it was impossible ever to get it right, that all you could be was a transmission belt for deception.
Was it the deception war that was really bothering you?
Well, I didn't, you know, I had come into journalism and I've adapted to it believing that what was worthy about it was telling people what happened yesterday. I have sort of a school teacher's yen to make people understand, to see. And that's what I wanted to do in journalism. Other than if you couldn't do that, it wasn't worth doing, I thought. And I felt that I had discovered that you couldn't do it. Therefore, you know, I wasn't making something that was useful, as my father had done.
My favorite story about being deceived or not being spoken to straightly as a reporter was the Lyndon Johnson story. Well, I think this was maybe the first time you interviewed him, and he was telling you stuff, and you figured, well, he knows who you are and so on, and he sends out a note to somebody during the interview.
Oh, yes. I've dined out on that story for years.
Oh, it's a great story, though. I think anybody who's ever interviewed anyone would relate to this story. Tell the story.
Well, by that time, I had worked with Lyndon Johnson for years. I'd known him since 1954, 55, because I'd been covering the Senate when he was Senate Majority Leader. I'd seen him in all modes and forms of dress. I'd seen him in his pajamas at dawn. I'd seen him drinking too much at midnight. And he'd become vice president by this time. So we're talking about 1961 or 62. And I was covering the Senate one day, and Johnson, who'd been forgotten, nobody knew he was alive, ran into me in the corridor one day and pulled me into his office and started talking. And, oh, he talked and talked and talked and talked. He talked for 45 minutes, nonstop, as only Johnson could. And at some point in this endless monologue, he wrote something on a piece of paper, buzzed his secretary in, gave her the paper. She went out to the next room. A few minutes later, she came back with another piece of paper. He looked at it, crumpled up, nodded, threw it away, and went on talking. And when I finally escaped, you know, I was on deadline, running down the hall, discovered I was being pursued by another reporter, a friend of mine, who'd been in the outer office when that Johnson's note came out. And he said to me, he said, do you know what was on that note that Johnson sent out when you were in there? I said, no, what? He said, it said, who is this I'm talking to? Well, it was a wonderful lesson in humility, which newspaper men need more of, I suspect.
Yeah, and you felt that he wasn't talking to you, he was talking to the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Washington reporters need to keep that in mind. They often confuse themselves with the organization that they represent, but the politicians never do.
You spent the first part of your career at the Baltimore Sun and then moved over to the New York Times, first to cover the White House beat. And you didn't seem to like that very much, judging from your book, and it seemed that there were so many people covering everything from the Times that there wasn't always enough work to do, and there were sometimes too many reporters on a story, you felt.
Yeah, but you must remember that when I came to the White House, I had been in London for a year and a half, 2 years, whatever. And I'd gone to London at 27 as a correspondent for The Sun, and they offered me the job covering the White House. Then I switched over to the Times. Well, it sounds glamorous. It's wonderful you're going to be the White House correspondent. You know, it's top of the world, Ma, right? Everybody wants to be White House correspondent. Well, I checked into the White House the first day over there, and it took me about 36 hours to realize I'd made one of the world's great mistakes. I had sacrificed London for the honor of sitting in this sealed room listening to White House correspondents snore. Absolutely nothing went on. You know, you were given press releases periodically, and you took them back to the office and typed them out. A copy boy could have done the work. But you had your name on page one every day. Well, that was my experience at the Sun. Scotty Reston came along, hired me to the Times, and promised I wouldn't have to. He would take me off the White House. I had to go up to New York first and worked in that enormous city room of the New York Times, where they had so many people that the city editor had a loudspeaker system. He summoned the staff to the city desk over a series of amplifiers hung through the city room. I felt utterly lost. And somebody said, don't be alarmed. People were sitting around playing bridge. There was a running bridge game. Other people were doing the crossword puzzle. It looked like people who hadn't done anything for weeks. And somebody said, the Times always likes to be well-staffed in case the Titanic sinks. They've got enough reporters to cover it. So I went back to Washington, and pretty soon Scotty Reston had me covering the White House again. There was no escaping Washington.
You went from reporting to writing a column at the New York Times. You were almost wooed away by the Baltimore Sun, but the Times made you a counteroffer to stay, and they offered you a column there. When you started writing the column, did you start writing it humorously at the very beginning?
No, I had no idea what it was going to be. I had never thought of writing a column that would be humorous, that anybody would call humorous. I incidentally still don't think of it as a humor column, but it certainly wasn't conceived in those terms. I really didn't have any clear idea what I was going to do, but I thought it was going to be a casual essay kind of column, a casual column, as they say, and what I was firm about was that the diction would be primarily an Anglo-Saxon kind of English rather than Latin English. For example, you know, I would say use instead of utilize. I would say do instead of implement. I would put it in the mother tongue, so to speak, because so much of the Times in those days was written, it sounded as though it had been written in Latin and translated directly into English. And I thought I would write it in simple English prose, very direct, and it would be casual. And that's what I did for several weeks. Just whatever came along in the news, I would comment on copying some of the style that I'd discovered E.B. White doing in the old Talk of the Town in the New Yorker. And after several weeks, Time Magazine's press section had a piece saying there is a humorist at the Times, and it turned out to be about me. And I was astonished, also a little appalled, because I hadn't thought I was doing humor. And I concluded finally that, anything that was in plain English at the Times in those days must seem funny. That's how I got that tag laid on me. But I wasn't interested in doing humor. In fact, if I'd told anybody at the Times in those days that this was going to be a humor column, they probably would have fired me.
Once you started writing the column, did you get out of the house very much? I mean, you used to be on a beat where you had to be out and reporting all the time.
Yeah, the hardest thing about going from reporting to a column is the discovery that as a columnist, if you have a fact, you're in trouble. A column is a reflection of a mind, that's all, of a mind that's confronted with certain data that everybody else is confronted with. Is it an interesting mind, a dull mind, an extraordinary mind, a weird mind? The column will reveal that. But it's not a business of conveying information. And when I first took it on, I couldn't get out of the habit of going to fires. You know, I'd go to the White House, I'd go to the Senate, I'd go to the State Department, wherever the story of the day was. I was there taking notes and coming back and trying to turn it into a column. And I had a good friend who sat across the aisle. Every once in a while, I'd show him one and say, "What do you think?" And he'd shake his head, "No." And he said, "It's not a column, it's reporting." So it was a terrible, terribly difficult transition. And, of course, because in American journalism, you're trained to keep yourself, to keep your personality out of what you write, it's very difficult to get in the habit of suffusing whatever you're writing with your personality, which you must do to make a column successful. If the column doesn't express your personality or some aspect of it very forcefully, it won't succeed.
My guest is columnist Russell Baker, who's written a new memoir called The Good Times. I want to go back in time a little bit to a subject that you've written about in both of your memoirs, and that's the subject of your mother. In both of your books, you've written about her ambition for you to become something and for you to never be a quitter. How do you think that drive both helped and perhaps hurt you?
Well, that's a very old American thing. I guess even today, you're supposed to make something of yourself, aren't you? That was my mother's message. If you work hard, you make something of yourself. Apply yourself. You'll be somebody. You make something of yourself. Well, it gets translated very quickly into making a lot of money. That's commonly what happens because somebody said, William Hamilton, I think, said, in America, money is life's report card. How do you know you've made something of yourself if you don't have the money to show it? So, I had been marinated in this approach to life. You had to make something of yourself. So, or as the sociologists would say these days, I was intensely success-oriented. I pursued success with great zeal and vigor. And I was successful. In a way, this book is about being successful when young. And what happens at the end, what I discovered was that that day, sitting in the Senate corridor, growing up, if you will, that being successful wasn't enough. There was more to it than that. And, you know, I thank God for my mother's help and insistence that I do make something of myself, because I didn't have much will to until she got behind me. But at the same time, it had given me a kind of tunneled vision view of life that wasn't entirely healthy, I think. And when I reached that stage, 36, 37, it was necessary to have another look at myself and see if there wasn't more to life than being successful.
And what did you find?
Well, I don't know. That's the next book. After success, what?
Well, do you know yet? I mean, will you find out when you write the book what the answer to that question is?
Of course. I mean, how do I know what I think if I haven't written it first?
You know?
Writing is thinking, you know.
By the time you're in your 30s, I guess, in your new book, you've become a pretty good drinker. Was that ever a problem for you?
No, I didn't have, you mean the alcoholism?
Mm-hmm.
No. I drank because it was what you did in to be a newspaper man when I came into the business. I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day, and I didn't drink every day, but, you know, I drank on every occasion when you had time to drink. I was afraid to drink on the job, never drank on the job, because I discovered very quickly if you drank, you couldn't write. You know, you thought you were writing brilliantly, and then you saw it the next day, and you discovered you'd made a fool of yourself.
Mm.
But drinking was what, it went with the territory in those days. You're probably too young to remember the old movies with Lee Tracy and Adolph Monju, all those movies made in the 30s about the romance and glamour of city rooms, all based on the front page, of course. And the strong feature of all of them were the cigarettes were going and the booze was flowing. So I had to do those things to qualify as a reporter.
I still
like to drink. I tend to favor wine more expensive than I can afford these days.
Did your mother ever feel that there were consequences that her ambitions had that she hadn't counted on? For instance, when her health started failing, you were, I believe, in Europe or something on assignment. I mean, that your success made it difficult for you to spend as much time with her as she probably would have liked.
Oh, I don't think that bothered her, no. No, you know, of course, my mother lived to be a very old age. She, relatively old, it doesn't seem as old as it used to. She died at 87. This book ends with her funeral, in fact. She was 87 by that time and had been hopelessly senile for 6 years. She collapsed at about 80, and her mind went out. It's as though all the circuits of her brain broke down simultaneously. But to that time, she had never indicated that she wanted to spend more time with me. It wasn't that that she wanted. What she wanted was something to talk about to the neighbors, you know. It's so typical. It's like a bad story. She would bore the neighbors to death with tales of her son, the columnist or the White House correspondent or whatever. But when she saw me, it was always, this isn't good enough. You know, if you work at this White House job, you might really make something of yourself. If you work at this column, you might make something of yourself. So she was enjoying that success that I was having, and didn't especially want me around the house or underfoot by any means.
Mm-hmm. Ever still have dreams about writing that novel?
No, I have no interest in writing fiction. I discovered journalism shown me that the world that's right in front of my eyes is so much more interesting and complex than any my imagination is capable of creating, that it would be foolish for me to try fiction. I just don't have the gift for it. Fiction's a special gift and requires a special kind of commitment that I have no interest. I just couldn't do that.
Russell Baker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.